Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, you are listening to Speaking Broadly, and this is your host, Dana Cowan. Each week, I interview outstanding people in the food world to discover their unique approach to their lives and careers, how they overcome obstacles, and how they embrace opportunity. Today, I have as my guest a woman who pivoted from an incredibly successful career in book publishing to follow her love of cooking. She launched the Mom 100, which provides awesome recipes for members of picky families, happy families, all families. And she's also an incredibly prolific writer and spokesperson and a really good friend of mine, Katie Workman. Katie, I'm so happy to have you in that stripey broken chair next to me.
Thank you. It's delightful to be sitting with you in the stripey broken chair.
The thing is, I get to ask you all these questions that, you know, they'd be polite to ask as a friend, but they're so much more relevant on air.
Right. It's very, I mean, we have had 4,2900 conversations, and this one will be taped.
So when I was thinking about, like, what is the meaning of Katie Workman, I was really putting some thought into this, and what is the work of Katie Workman, I came down to one salient fact that somehow, unbelievably, I had not thought of before. But it all seems to come together around the notion of family. And I say that because you were born into a publishing family. In fact, your father, Peter Workman, founded Workman Publishing the year you were born. So you were co-born.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, sometimes think of us as weird twins and like from different, like, I don't know.
Same father,
for sure. The mother is the mailman. I don't know, but like, you know, something like that. But yeah, there's definitely a connectivity.
And so you grew up in publishing. You started your career in publishing. You were at Clarkson Potter for 12 years in marketing, and then Workman for 4 as associate publisher. And then now you've created these books that are about family, but from a completely different point of view in doing the Mom 100. So when you think about the role of family in your life, like, what do you think of?
Well, it's interesting. I think that that is an absolutely accurate theme to pick out. And then it's sort
of...
What are you talking about? I think that it actually sort of has a couple different like tentacles to it. One is that family for me is actually the family, you know, born into, you know, nuclear family, the family that like my husband, my kids, but I also very much feel like that there is a created family. Like I have very much think of my close friends as family. Like that is, if anything, like I have relationships that I think of as incredibly familial when there is no blood tie or no marital tie, but that's just, they're sort of have the same depth of importance to me. And then the other piece of it, I think that when I think of like what ties stuff together for me and going back to family momentarily is also just the notion of feeding people, which is just sort of a constant. And if I, anything that I'm cooking or creating or writing is always meant to sort of end up feeding somebody because the exercise of it. I mean, Gary and the boys were away for 5 days recently. I did not cook one thing. I ate popcorn. I ate leftovers. I ate like shitty frozen.
You can say shitty.
Oh, shitty. Yay. You know, I just nibbled my way through the days. And because to cook without somebody on the other end of the plate has no interest for me whatsoever.
Wow. Because for some people, cooking is a practice. Cooking is a meditation. You know, cooking is an
nope. I mean, I love cooking, but it's all about like the sharing it with someone and possibly the slightly like neediness of having somebody say like, oh my God, this was so good, or, you know, thank you for making that for me. It's something about the, you know, the exchange over feeding somebody.
Or the feedback.
Right, right. Well done.
Thank you.
So let's just start at the beginnings. When you were growing up and you were surrounded by books constantly and the creative life, did that call to you in some way? What were those dinner table conversations? I'd love to know.
Yes. I mean, there was books everywhere, books having to do with, you know, that my father published, but also just, you know, fiction and biographies. Like, there's just, the walls were lined with bookshelves. The bookshelves were filled with books. There were books piled everywhere. You know, reading was important. Books were important. And food was really important. And my father published cookbooks, amongst many other books, early huge successes such as Silver Palette Cookbook, and then the ensuing Sheila Lukens and Julie Wasso books, and then many more Sheila Lukens books, and then other very well-known cookbooks and very well-respected cookbooks. But I read cookbooks, and it's sort of not that unusual now, I guess, that, you know, people do, and cookbooks are written to be read in ways that were different than they used to be. But I, at night in bed, was more often with a cookbook.
Why is that?
I don't know. I was so interested. And then the Silver Palette was in particular so important. I literally taught myself how to cook by cooking my way through that book. Again, like way before, I mean, there wasn't an internet. There didn't occur to me to blog or even journal about it. You know, it was the way I taught myself how to cook.
Is that because your mother didn't cook?
She was a good cook. She is a good cook, but she was not a teachery cook. And she wasn't we do cook together now for the holidays, but she wasn't a, let's all come in the kitchen and make something together. It was sort of like she did her thing and then I did my thing, and then I was always getting into trouble for not cleaning up properly. That was actually one of my earliest memories, is my mother lifting up the toaster oven constantly where I had swept all the crap underneath it and being like, this is not clean. So I was always shoving things, you know, underneath things. So I was a messy cook. But anyway, I taught myself how to cook. I made pasta from Marcella Hazan's, you know, Essentials of Italian Cooking. It was like that 7-page recipe with the line drawings, and I followed it like just painstakingly. And, you know, connecting dots now at my ripe old age is like, huh, I asked for a typewriter when I was 10, a pasta maker when I was 12, I got a Cuisinart for my graduation gift. It's like, you know, the dots aren't all that, you know, obscure to connect at this point. But
so you were cooking from these great cookbooks. You had a close proximity to them, which means some of those authors you knew. In the case of Marcella Hazan, she's quite daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, you've written 2 cookbooks of your own. And what was that like, just thinking about, you know, the heritage of cookbooks, like what they mean?
Yeah.
And how did you think about how you could contribute in, you know, add your own voice to that?
I think I don't know that I would have gotten there. Like, it's interesting because I wrote these books and it sort of started in a very casual way. And I think if I had overthought it or like allowed myself to be like intimidated, like, what am I going to add to the pantheon? You know, like, what is the role my cookbook will play in, you know, generations to come? That would have paralyzed me, and I would have just crawled into a ball and, you know, rolled under the couch along with the breadcrumbs that I had swept under there. But the longtime editor at Workman Publishing, which is the company my father, Peter, started, who I've known for my entire life, literally, she is retiring this Friday after 43 years.
Wow.
So an amazing person that I've known my entire life, editor of Silver Palette, Stephen Reichlin, Cake Mix Doctor, I mean, like, you name it, many, many, many cookbooks. I at that time was an online editor for a recipe website, and I had been writing the newsletter and for, you know, 2 years, the weekly newsletter, and it was popular and was getting good feedback, and I had been writing for some other websites. And she called me up and took me out to lunch and said, I think you should write a cookbook. And I said, I was frankly slightly taken aback. I was surprised. And then I had had the idea for the Mom 100 in my brain, but more in the sense I was thinking, somebody should write a cookbook. Somebody should write a book that has like 100 recipes that every mom needs in her back pocket, because it was, my kids were younger then, and it was that same, you know, no matter how adept you are in the kitchen, no matter how much you love cooking, no matter what you know, you still stare at a package of chicken breasts and think, oh God, I cannot make the same thing. And your kid still comes home and says, oh, there was a bake sale tomorrow, I forgot to tell you, I signed you up to make brownies. And you still, like, you know, want your kids to eat more fish and more vegetables. And so many parents face these similar day in, day out things. So I had this idea, but I really was thinking, like, somebody should write that. And so she said at lunch, do you have any ideas? And I said, well, this one idea. And she said, I love it. And write a proposal. And I did. And
as I recall, you actually had to negotiate with your father for the fee.
It was...
That sounds
awful. It sucked. I actually didn't negotiate with him per se, but she brought the proposal. Other people at Workman really loved it. I think partly out of nervousness, and also he might not have like really gotten the idea right at the beginning, but he was resistant. But Suzanne fought for it and said, we're publishing this book. And he finally agreed, and she made an offer, which was paltry. And I said, like, oh, can you do a little bit better? And she said, I could probably go up like, you know, a few thousand. And I was like, okay. And accepted the offer. And that night, bizarrely, he was coming over to dinner. My parents were coming over to dinner, happenstance. And I remember he was lying on the couch, and he was reading the newspaper, and I was cooking dinner. And at some point I said, I guess we're publishing a book together. Like, did you know this? And he sort of went, yep. And I don't think he looked up from the paper.
Oh my God.
It was just like, I think he really was, and we really did want to try to keep as much as possible this church and state thing, because it's really weird to have your father publish your book or publish your daughter's book. But he was incredibly hands-off during the entire process until it was coming out, and then he really got it. So he was...
That must have been gratifying.
It was very gratifying. This was a man from whom a compliment was a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did not grow on trees.
No.
So you spent, well, at least a decade and a half in publishing.
Yeah.
Much of it in marketing roles.
Well, I started as an editor. I was a cookbook editor. I started as an editorial assistant to somebody who was primarily a cookbook editor, and that was intentional on my part. Pam Krause.
Oh my gosh.
Pam Krause hired me. Hi, Pam.
Hey, Pam.
Hi, Pam.
We love you, Pam.
Still one of my best friends to this day. She hired me right out of college, and I was her assistant, and she got me promoted fairly quickly, and I was on my own as a cookbook editor in a fairly short amount of time publishing-wise. And then...
Do you think that there's a knack? Like, do you think there's a genealogy connection knack to finding a story?
In terms of, like, hereditary, like, from my dad kind of thing?
Or do you feel like you were looking for different things? Because Workman did great packaging. You are a genius at coming up with the ways things should go together.
Well, people often say, you know, oh, publishing is in your blood kind of thing. And I can't say that I would argue with that. I can't say that I don't get that or I don't think that's not true. And, you do come, you know, even if you're an avid reader and from a reading family, not necessarily a publishing family, you get to understand the importance very quickly of voice, right? Because a point of view, voice, if you... especially increasingly so, and you can say the same things about social media, you can say the same things about any sort of art form or anything that has to do with storytelling in the slightest, which is that if you don't have a particular point of view that's truly true to who you are, people will say, oh, I want to write a book, what kinds of things sell? Well, bad way to go about that, yes, obviously you could say, oh, you know, what's the next Instant Pot? And I want to try to like get on that bandwagon. So it's not impossible to try to suss things out from a more commercial or mercenary or marketing point of view. But if you want to write a book that is going to reach people in a certain way, other than just be sort of a perfunctory, you know, useful thing, then it's going to be people reacting to how you think, how you write, how you express yourself. It's got to be, it's got to come from a place of pure honesty. It can't be manufactured. And that's sort of true of everything. That's a universal truth. And then when it comes to writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, you know, that just becomes critical. And then the other thing to layer on it is, like, if you're not passionate about what you're writing about, it is a slog of a process, and it will come across in your writing. Your audience will smell that in a second. And why are you wasting your, why would you ever want to spend your time? Writing a book is a really, really, really hard thing to do. And if it's not something you feel passionate about, then it's just fairly joyless.
Okay, that's bad. So you were a cookbook editor.
Mm-hmm. And then in marketing. I was in marketing. I did get involved with the marketing side of things, which, you know, again, would be something people would tie back. Peter was sort of a genius marketer. And I don't know. How much do you know is like, oh, this comes from, you know, like, it's very hard to parse it out.
Yeah. And you're so much, I mean, in talking about voice, one of the great things about all the things you write is that they sound like you. I mean, they're funny, and they have so much personality, and you really sound like you're sitting next to me. So when I'm cooking through something, even an instruction like, you know, watch out for be sure to put the cheese on top, because if you fold it in, it's going to be a mush.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. your writing has so much... has so much character to it.
Which you were one of the very first readers of the manuscript and one of the very few readers of an early manuscript. And I remember, it was actually, you know what I'm thinking of now? Because I was already being very voicey, but you were just like, more voice. It's like more cowbell, like Saturday Night Live. You were like, more.
Well, you have this gift. Food writing can be so... dreary, mm-hmm. Because it can be just all cliches, right?
I mean, it can be cliches, it can be sanctimonious, it can be holier than thou, it can be precious, it can be dry, it can be a
earnest.
Lot of, yeah, ooh, earnest, God.
Yeah, worst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just got, I'm sorry if this person is listening, but I've been interviewing new assistants and I actually have been getting, like, you know, lots and lots of applications, and one of them was like, what my happiness is when I'm floating through the halls of the Green Market, the scents of tendrils pulling at my nostrils, my hands immersed in the verdant green of the mescal. I was like, ooh, ha. It made me very anxious.
Yeah, let's cut some of those words out. Yeah. Bad. So I just want to circle back for a second to this marketing and how... and how you think about that, because there are people who believe that marketing is at the root of all success at this point. And you, mm-hmm. You're so successful across so many channels. Like, what is it that you learned inside a marketing department or leading one that you feel is just useful for people to know?
That is a big question. It's funny. I guess... always things come back, and I feel like I'm going to be a complete broken record on this, to say something genuine, because, you know, yes, there are tricks of the trade in different channels. Like, take Instagram, for instance, right? One of the biggest food marketing vehicles of our time at this moment. And knowing which hashtags to use, how many hashtags to use, who to tag in your photos, how often to post, when to post, what kind of pictures work, how, you know, there's tons of stuff you can study away, and there are definitely things you can do that are helpful. But in the end, you have to think about, when somebody is looking at Instagram, what will pull them, what is their reaction going to be towards? You know, what, because when you're looking at Instagram, you know, what are you drawn to? And in the end, it does come back to something genuine, right? Whether it's somebody posting something that's like a little behind the scenes, or, you know, a little self-deprecating, or, you know, saying something funny in the caption, or something just beautiful, right? Beautiful, beautiful. And the cheese pull never hurts. That's the moral of the story. You can incorporate a cheese pull, forget everything I said before. That's the secret to life.
You're done.
Yeah.
So how hard was it to make that decision to leave publishing which you knew so well, and then be your own, be on your own?
It was definitely one of the hardest decisions I've ever made in my life, because at that point, as you well know, I was working at Workman. My father had urged me to go into book publishing, saying, you know, you love food, go into cookbook publishing, it would be fun for you. And I have very severe food allergies. And so the sort of thinking was like, gosh, going the traditional, like, I'm going to be a chef or I'm going to be a cook route would have been more challenging. And I was unsure of myself enough to sort of let him urge me into a cookbook publishing career. One thing led to another. Suddenly I was at Clarkson Potter for 12 years. Not unhappily, but there was this big chunk of time and this was my area. At that point, Peter had been lobbying me to come to Workman, saying, you know, sort of like, well, if you're it wasn't, or if you're going to be in publishing, like,
you might as well do it here.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was something.
Why are you competing with me?
more that, like, I think the real hope was that I would love it enough to want to continue continue his company on. And I went because I didn't want to say no, and I didn't want to have regrets about not going. And I was there for 4 years, not unhappily. Loved the books, loved the people. It's another family for me. It completely and totally is. But all of a sudden, I was realizing that I was about to become a book publisher, and in the end, that was never what I wanted to be.
How was it just saying no to Peter? Because that is the crux of it, right? It's not just that you left publishing, which you had done for...
I left my dad's company, and I said I'd... So I did it in the form of a letter because I couldn't trust myself to speak the words without overwhelming emotion. And I basically wrote a letter to him explaining that I was going to leave. I was leaving book publishing, I was leaving Workman, and I was going to go try to figure out... In the end, I remember expressing it. I was like, I want to find something that brings me as much satisfaction and joy as this has brought you. And I can't do that and be here. So I did, and it was. But I made a drinks date with him for that night. I put it in his book, knowing that, like...
Oh, his calendar, yeah.
Gave him the letter saying, like, it's not that I don't want to talk to you, you need to read this first, and then we'll talk. So, my mother, who worked there too at the time, I remember I had warned her that this was happening, so like right before, so that she would not, be a little prepared. And he walked into her office and apparently said, like, this is a very good letter. So I guess I wrote a good letter, but he was sad and he was disappointed, but then he was very supportive. I mean, he was supportive. And I think probably up until the time he died, I always thought I would change my mind. So, you know, but...
And he died in 2013. Did mm-hmm. his death pull on you as if I should have made a different choice?
No, not in the slightest. I never really look back. I'm really good with this. My mother owns the company. I'm still involved with it. It's thriving. When I think about all of the pieces of this, it was actually a really great thing that the book came out in spring of 2012, and he got sick with glioblastoma a few months later and then died 6 months after that. So he died pretty much, it was like almost like a year to the day after my book came out. And the last 6 months were, you know, he was very ill and having surgeries, but the first 6 months he got to sort of see the book, and it's really like in terms of sort of closure or regrets or non-regrets, like, I'm very glad that he got to see the book, and I'm very glad that he was very proud of it. He was proud of it, and, you know, again, not a man who, you know, lavish with the old compliments. So I think he got to see what I, you know, some of what I wanted to do.
I think that makes a huge difference. I remember my father, who died when I was...
You were so young.
Well, I was 32, so I wasn't
That's
that
pretty young.
I wasn't that young. But, you know, he, I think, felt responsible for certain things in my life that, you know, I was such a daddy's girl. He's like, as long as I'm alive, you know, are you ever going to find a husband. And I'm like, oh, you don't have to die for me to find a husband.
Like, that's a little extreme, Dad.
It's just too much. But
oh my gosh.
But
wait, how old were you when you met Barclay?
I was 36.
Okay.
So yeah, there was a chunk of time in between there. And so my current husband, my only husband.
Hey, Barclay.
Hi, Bark.
You're still in the running, buddy.
never got to meet my father, which is a shame. But yes, I also feel like I became the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine when I was 34. And so my father missed that. And he would have loved that. You know, he just would have been so... He was already proud of me, but that would have just been great.
Yeah.
And I had friends of his write me letters just saying, your father was so proud, but this would have really made him happy.
Yeah. And it's funny, no matter how many years or decades go by, there are definitely, there's always certain things, and this is true of every child and every parent, mother, you know, anyone who's not there any longer, there are certain things that you wish you could tell them. And it doesn't matter how much time has gone by, because you know that that particular thing would have made them really proud or really excited.
Right. And even though I believe in, the essence of people surrounding you.
Yeah.
So there's some sense in which my father, has a sense of what's going on and that satisfaction. Those moments when I just feel like, oh, that make him so, like, he'd get such a kick out of this.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. That's, like, in the nutshell, what often, I mean, sometimes it's pride, sometimes it's this, but sometimes it's just, like, he'd get such a kick out of this is a great way to phrase it.
Yeah. So,
that was my AP column, I will tell you. And that was actually Anne Bramson, who you also know, longtime, wonderful, extraordinary editor, cookbook editor, you know, Thomas Keller's editor. When I got the weekly AP column, she just came up to me. She's like, Peter would have died, which is sort of, but she just was like, because he actually, it was funny because he used to sit in meetings when something got picked up on the AP wire, any publicity for any of the books, he would be like, and it just keeps going and going and going, because AP just is on the wire and people can pick it up and things run in many, many papers in many, many cities and over many, many months, if not years. So it's sort of this like gift that keeps on giving. And it had never occurred to me that I forgot how much he loved AP for this. So,
and now that you're writing for them, that's just like, it's so sweet. And he knows it somewhere. With that, we're going to take a commercial break, and we will be back with more of Katie Workman and Dana Cowan. That's me on Speaking Broadly.
The following program has been brought to you by Root 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Root 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. An incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Root 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit rt11.com.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly. Today, my guest is Katie Workman of the Mom 100. She also happens to be the only person who I've shared pizza with while talking to all of you. So I don't know, Katie, there's a first for everything.
I know, it's very exciting and it's very, very good pizza.
I mean, if you're at Roberta's and you're never eating the pizza in the podcast room, like, what are you doing
if
here?
You don't know what the podcast room is in Roberta's, you are sitting in a glassed-in room watching people eat pizza while you're not eating pizza, and then that just can only go on for so long.
And then it must change.
Yes.
So we were talking about...
And there's a Bloody Mary out there.
I know. That has not made it into the studio yet.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, next time. We were talking about your first book and the timing of the first book, which was so extraordinary because it was in 2012 and you published at Workman Publishing with your, at your family's publishing house, weird as that is, and great as that was. And then your father passed away a year later, having the opportunity to see you succeed and to see how you are taking your life in a new and different direction from the past years when you had been on the editor marketing side mm-hmm. of books. So when you decided to devote yourself to cooking, you really didn't know exactly where it was going to take you.
No.
Right? So you decided to leave because it leave Workman Publishing because it wasn't fulfilling you. You went to find what would fulfill you. Mm-hmm. And how did you sort out the thing that would become your next phase?
I mean,
is that English?
Like, yes.
You had a job and then you didn't have a job. How did you figure out how to like make your next job?
Yeah, it was scary. I mean, it was very scary to leave without a job, which is what I did. And then I ended up working at this online recipe website, which I did for a couple of years. It was a startup and very challenging, and I learned a lot. And then during that time was when Suzanne approached me about writing the book. So I started writing the book and then phased out of this online company. And then just things started to just stack themselves and evolve.
Nothing stacks itself. How did you do that? And like, how much thought went into it? And how much of it was like one foot in front of the other? Like, I like to cook. I'm going to have people over. I like to write. Let me see if I can write. I mean, because these were all new things to you because you'd had a career doing something
right on the
else.
Other side of the desk, basically. So, I am a person with a lot of energy, and I'm a person who doesn't really do hanging out or sitting still or like not much. I'm not good at not doing not much. So there's like, I guess it's sort of constantly like, oh, you know, what if I tried this and what if I met this person? And just everything, just like if something was going to lead to something, like I would sort of like, eagerly follow the thread, like keep going down whatever path was sort of like opening, or if there was a door, sort of looking into the door. And if there was, and it was, you know, I had a lot of connections in the food world, like you, for instance, right? And, you know, and Pam and, you know, Jennifer Baum and all, you know, lots of people who in lots of areas of food, friends who were helpful, and I just knew, you know, so I mean,
you had a good foundation.
I had a good foundation.
There are a lot of people that you could reach out to. Jennifer Baum does PR.
Yep.
Pam Krause was the editor with whom you worked.
And Pam, like, you know, Pam was Ina Garten's editor. So, like, getting a quote from Ina Garten for my book, I mean, yes, Ina Garten would never have given me quotes for my books had she not felt that way, felt strongly positively about them. She would never do such a thing. But I could get to Ina Garten. So, you know, there was years of foundation that were, in fairness, helpful to me. If people didn't like what I did, like it would have only gone so far. You can't make a success out of just knowing people.
I love that Gia De Laurentiis blurbed you.
Oh, Giada, and that was through Pam too, because Giada, it was very cute actually. Pam had asked her to read the manuscript for quite, and she was like, you know, you keep talking about her, and Katie this, Katie that, but I've never met her. Make her come here. She was shooting in New York with Pam for this online magazine that they were doing. She's like, why doesn't she just come here so I can meet her and you can stop telling me about her?
Wow, I love that.
Yeah, it was really cute. And so there off I went to, you know, and hung out with her for the day or, you know, for the part of the shoot. And, you know, that's, and then she, you know, again, she really liked the book because she has a daughter.
She has a great relationship to the type of food that you do because it's, her food is quite simple and direct and your food is direct as well with a point of view. I mean, each of you has a different point of view, which makes it easier for her to blurb you.
Yeah. And then there's just like, and I feel like there are a lot of really, I feel like I, over the years, have gone to, if there's something I can do, I'll do it, not necessarily knowing, oh, this X will lead to Y, because you never know what X is going to lead to. But I go to an IACP, I meet an editor, suddenly I'm writing for Cooking Light. I go to a blogger conference and meet somebody who, you know, works at a brand that I really love. We start communicating, and then I'm developing recipes for that person. So it's like, you do have to be proactive, you have to follow the thread, but it's also like, I wouldn't go up to somebody who worked at a pan company I didn't like and be like, I love your pans. I want to, you know. But then usually I'm like, oh, look, I actually have 3 pictures of your pan in my cookbook. And they're like, oh, you know.
What a good partnership this would
what
be.
What a good partnership this yeah. would be.
But I think it's sort of putting yourself in places where yes. good things can happen.
Yes.
And having a lot of energy
yes.
towards that. I mean, as you say, you definitely don't lack for energy or ideas once you meet somebody or right. charisma that would make them sort of want to work with you. So, you know, anyone who's looking what to do next, just find some charisma and put yourself out there.
There's the charisma story. No, but it is, I mean, in a nutshell, what you just said about putting yourself in places where things could happen and not predetermining what thing you want to happen.
Right.
Because that's, I think, a little bit futile and possibly self-sabotaging in some way, but I know every time I've gone out to tape something, meet someone, gone to a conference, something interesting has happened, and I probably couldn't have predicted any single one of them.
Right, and you're sort of open to the yeah. universe. So when you were in that transition, because you were working, but it also wasn't the thing.
It wasn't the thing.
You know, you woke up in the morning and you panicked. You woke up in the morning and you said, like, I'm going to do 9 other things because this isn't the thing. What did you do?
The first, so I really wasn't working, I guess, for about 6 months after I left Workman. I had like a couple little freelancy things here and there, but I was nowhere near the this is the thing. And it was very disconcerting. And I will tell you, it's so funny because I remember, you know, I've many friends who work, and I'm thinking about women specifically, but both sexes, many friends who work and many who don't. And the ones who don't, you know, often are doing really interesting things in terms of, you know, they're photographers or they donate a lot of time to their school or a charity that they really believe in. So there's a lot of very good ways to spend your time if working and or earning money isn't a priority for you for whatever circumstances. But there I was for the first time as a non-working person, first time in my life. And I, when my kids were, they were little and they were in school, and I had, like, I remember just, like, being very suddenly attuned to, like, all the dynamics of, like, pickup, right? Like, all that shit where, like, you know, it's like the nanny or someone's picking up and, like, somebody's kids are making play dates or, like, three mothers are talking. You don't know anyone. You're standing there with this, like, idiotic, pleasant smile on your face waiting for your kid to come out. Like, and all of that world was, like, I just remember feeling completely unplugged from it and not like I even wanted to be plugged into it, but it was, like, suddenly that was sort of the shape of the day for a little while. Not that I wasn't having conversations or thinking or looking and, you know, exploring things, but I was unmoored. For that was an unmooring situation for me.
And then you remoored pretty. You sailed out of that.
Yes, it wasn't. It was like, because I remember standing there, and you know, there was times where I'd be working and could pick up my kids too, but there would just be like a lot of conversation. This is going to come across as super judgmental, and I'm already apologizing for it. But I remember there's just the enormous amounts of conversations between people who are picking up their kids about, like, how the tile came in from Morocco for the kitchen, and it just, like, they couldn't, it was never the shade of blue that the contractor had said. And the other, and, you know, and the other person was going, like, oh, that's terrible. I was like,
like, maybe not so bad.
Maybe not the world's terrible. Like, you know, like that's like, you know, I did not feel comfortable, and I didn't feel like I belonged to a world. I was.
And so you went in search of that. So the book that you proposed to Suzanne Rafer, the editor, turned out to be the Mom 100. You cook for your kids. You cook for everybody. Mm-hmm. You cooked for me when I had cancer. Mm-hmm. You're an amazing cook.
What? I remember like I would be asking you what you wanted in the beginning. You were like, oh, no, you don't have to. Anything's fine. I was like, you know I'm going to make something. It might as well be something you really want. And then you were great. You got like really specific. I remember there was an orange phase. You were like, I want squash and sweet potato.
I when I think of it, I just like flash to orange things. Also, that's so weird. Like, I feel like there
it's funny. There was a beta carotene portion of your treatment.
<Exactly. laughs> Thank you for that. Still thank you for that. But what is it like having the book sent around being a mom? Because, in fact, the way that your life sort of developed, yes, you are a mom, and yes, you have awesome, smart, funny children, but you are a working person, and then you flipped over, and that mom world's very specific.
It is, but, and I guess, you know, and I had like these weird moments of like, do I want to call it the Mom 100? But that was how I thought of it. That was the original shape or impulse of the book was, you know, and as I say very bluntly in the beginning of the book, like, you know, remember that perfume ad in the 80s? Like the woman, you know, she's making shit in the pan and like her husband's coming home and like, you know, she's never letting him forget he's a man and like, oh my God, like what a load of crap. And, you know, but the rest of us are standing there in the supermarket looking at chicken breasts and wrapped in plastic wrap and thinking like, oh God, what am I going to make tonight? And also just the reality of like, you know, on one end of the spectrum, oh, my little Johnny is such a good eater. He just loves sea urchin, you know, and that's obviously a super precious part of the world that, you know, my life butts up against. And then on the other side is like, oh God, you know, most people, my kid won't eat anything but chicken nuggets, the white food thing, you know, like how do I get my kids to eat fish, et cetera? Or, you know, I don't have that much time, or how do I plan, or, you know, what can I make ahead? All that stuff. So the majority of people, again, as I said in the book, who deal with this are moms. That's just, you know, do the stats, you know, take a poll. That's just the reality of it, good or bad. So that's how it got called the Mom 100, 100 recipes every mom needs in her back pocket. And you're right, I did, in a sense, that was the first book and then became the name of my blog and certainly has become sort of, in essence, like the core part of my brand. I now write a lot about, like, just in general, feeling comfortable in the kitchen, feeling, like, good about yourself, you know, having some things, like, under your belt, entertaining with happiness and ease and comfort and, you know, just life being happier in the kitchen in general. So, and in a sense, that was really the base of the Mom 100 to begin with, and it kind of happened to end up being about families and kids, but it was really about, don't take yourself so seriously. Don't take the whole thing so seriously. It's annoying when people say, like, cooking isn't rocket science because that's such a, like, repeated, boring thing. But it isn't. And, you know, and also just that sort of sense of, like, trying to, like, unbuckle ourselves from the constant flow of, you know, you read about this and this, there's this E. coli scare and should you do organic and what are the dirty dozen and
what are the dirty dozen?
It's the fruits and vegetables that you should buy organic because they're always, like, strawberries is one. Like, they say, like, if you're going to buy only a handful of things organically, strawberries is one. Like, bananas, don't worry about it. You're peeling the skin off, so who cares? Strawberries are, you know, if pesticides have been sprayed on them, like, you're really, that's not a good fruit to eat. But, so all that is to say, so people get, it's already paralyzing to cook, right? Like, people feel intimidated by being in the kitchen. People feel intimidated by, like, oh my God, am I giving my kids the right nutrients, the right foods, the right this, the right that? You layer on all the things that are deterrents or scary or intimidating, and suddenly you do end up just pulling out the box of macaroni and cheese and feeling like shit about yourself while you're doing it. So how many times can we?
Right. So I am curious about something else. You multitask more than anyone I've ever met, because we've talked about the AP, we've talked about your book, we've talked about your blog, we've talked a little bit about your partnerships, they came up. How do you find all those things, and then how do you manage all those things?
I have become aware that I have ADD. I'm not a joke. I mean, like, really, like, I am somehow, in a weird way, lucky enough. Some people have ADD and, like, there's just so much noise, they don't know where to concentrate, or they're just constantly distracted. I have a little of that, but I also somehow, like, can have all these things buzzing in simultaneous little compartments. I keep a lot of lists. I use Sharpie pens in all different colors, and no, they're not color-coded. People are always saying, are your lists color-coded? Because there's all these colors everywhere.
And how can you have a colored list that's not color-coded?
I don't know. Isn't that weird?
Yes, I find that weird.
But there's nothing, there's no rhyme or reason to it. I mean, I'm like going to pull out something and show you right now. Like, it's just, it's crazy. But having said all that, I keep lots of lists. I try to, like, hire people to help me who do things better than me, like take photographs or, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, make sure the SEO on my blog is green. But anyways, it's just endless amounts of lists that go on. And I don't know. I juggle things. I like having lots of things going on. It does get a little overwhelming. I'm not going to say that it won't. It does get a little overwhelming. And also, when you work for yourself, there's never, ever a minute that you don't feel like you could be working.
Right.
And I'm a sucker for that. I'm a real, you know, I'm unfortunately, like, if I have half an hour, I'm re-editing a recipe. I'm coming up with a new recipe. I'm you know, ordering the stuff for the next photo shoot. I'm, you know.
It's not very relaxing.
It's not very
relaxing. So you've had the privilege, really, to be surrounded by extraordinary people your entire life, partly because of the writers and the editors that were part of your extended family, and then the relationships that you have made with other authors, other creators, mm-hmm. as you've gone through your life. Who has inspired you the most, and what was your biggest takeaway from them?
That's a good question. I mean, I clearly have talked about my dad a lot as an inspirational person who really had, like, serious vision. I mean, people use words like visionary and genius and they get bandied about. But that did happen to me, my dad. My mom is also a very talented person. She's got a really good eye for things. And she also takes the time, like, where somebody would sort of put food on a plate and put it out, like, for a party. She would, like, be the person who'd, like, have a sprig of rosemary, a sprig of sage, and a sprig of thyme, like, artfully placed on the plate, and the plate would, like, all of a sudden you're like, oh, that looks a lot better. You know? So that's sort of, like, that care. And also, my parents were also very big hosts. They were very hospitable, and they were very hosty. They loved entertaining, and they loved making people feel welcome in their home. And so that I grew up with, and that has certainly carried over into our lives today. Re-ask your question, because I feel like I just veered off of your...
Well, the question is, who did you find most inspiring as a mentor or a friend, and what quality did they bring to that you either, you know, hope to have yourself or just to share with the listeners, like, someone who inspired you and what you learned?
I think that probably... the common denominator is sort of this generosity of spirit, right? It's that you are able to be helpful and inspirational to somebody, and you do it. You don't just gloss over or, you know, phone it in some way. So, I mean, again, I'll go back to you, Pam, you know, Suzanne, like, people who really had expertise and opportunity to share and did it, didn't just phone it in or talk about it or sort of be like, yeah, let me know if I can help, you know, like that kind of, like, thing where it's like
that's actually a pet peeve
phrase, and it comes, I think, actually from the cancer year, which was people would say, like, if there's anything I can do, and you're like, okay, what you can do is never say those words because I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Like, either do something.
Yeah.
And it's okay if you don't. I mean, it's not like I have an expectation, but that notion of not really asking,
yeah,
but acting, I think,
yes,
is
yes. So the people
compelling.
I guess I admire the most are people who act, who do things. I think that, again, probably to a fault, I am somebody sort of like, let's go, let's go, let's go. And I really look to people who make things happen, who, you know, whether they may have been given opportunities and connections, they may not. You know, you may not have like been like, oh, I was born in Ethiopia and I came here and made myself into this without anybody's help. You may have had help, but you took the help, you made something, and you gave the help back. Like, it's just, there's sort of that flow of support, and that's what I admire, and that's what I know that I would never have done what I've done on my own, and I hope that I am able to.
You're part of a great support network because you indeed yourself are unbelievably supportive and kind. So with those words, that is this episode of Speaking Broadly. I want to thank...
I can't believe how fast that went by. I'm not surprised.
Thank you, Katie, for joining me and being the first one to break the pizza in the bunker. And all of you listeners, I want to thank you for joining us today. I want to thank David Tadashore, amazing engineer whose hand I can see through the window, Carlin Thompson, who is my excellent aide, and we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.